How far Nero, through an excess of good fortune and wealth, lost his senses and abused fortune, or in what manner he dealt with his brother, his wife, and his mother, from whom he went on to extend his cruelty to the noblest men. And how at last, out of derangement, he sank to the stage and the theater, since this is common knowledge to all, I shall pass over, and turn instead to what happened among the Jews in his time. He gave Lesser Armenia to Aristobulus, son of Herod, to rule, and to Agrippa's kingdom he added four cities with their toparchies, Abila and Julia's in Perea, Tarichaea and Tiberias in Galilee, while over the rest of Judea he appointed Felix procurator. Felix captured the bandit chief Eleazar, who had plundered the country for 20 years, along with many of his companions, and sent them to Rome. The number of the brigands he crucified, and of the townspeople convicted of complicity with them whom he punished, was beyond counting. Once the country had been cleared of these, another kind of bandit began to grow up in Jerusalem, the so-called Sicarii, who murdered people in broad daylight and in the very heart of the city, mingling with the crowd especially at the festivals and concealing small daggers under their clothing, with which they stabbed their opponents. Then, once their victims had fallen, the killers themselves joined in the outcry of indignation, and by this show of good faith they went entirely undetected. The first to be assassinated by them was the high priest Jonathan. After him, many were killed daily, and the fear of these calamities was harder to bear than the calamities themselves, each person expecting death at any hour as if in wartime. Men kept watch from a distance for their enemies, and not even those approaching as friends could be trusted. In the midst of their suspicion, and on their guard, they were still cut down. Such was the speed of the plotters, and their skill at escaping notice. Along with these, there arose another band of villains, cleaner of hand but more impious in purpose, who did no less harm to the city's welfare than the assassins did. For deceivers and impostors, under the pretense of divine inspiration, worked to bring about revolutionary changes, and persuaded the crowd to act as if possessed and led them out into the wilderness, promising that their God would show them signs of freedom. Against these Felix, since he judged this the beginning of a revolt, sent cavalry and heavy infantry and destroyed a great number. But it was the Egyptian false prophet who inflicted an even greater blow on the Jews. This impostor, a magician who had given himself the standing of a prophet, came into the country and gathered about 30,000 of the deceived. Leading them around from the wilderness to the mount called the Mount of Olives, he intended from there to force his way into Jerusalem, overpower the Roman garrison and the people, and rule as a tyrant using the bodyguard who had burst in with him. But Felix anticipated his attack, meeting him with the Roman heavy infantry, and the whole populace joined in the defense, so that when the clash came, the Egyptian fled with a few followers, while most of those with him were killed or taken alive, and the rest of the crowd scattered and slipped away each to his own home. Once these two had been put down, as in a diseased body another part again became inflamed. For the magicians and bandits banded together and drove many into revolt, urging them on toward freedom and threatening death to those who submitted to Roman rule, declaring that they would forcibly strip away the position of those who chose to remain slaves willingly. Dividing themselves by companies throughout the country, they plundered the houses of the powerful, killed the owners, and set the villages on fire, so that the whole of Judea was filled with their madness. And this war, too, was kindled further day by day. Another disturbance arose around Caesarea, where the Jews mixed among the population, there fell into strife with the Syrians in the city. The Jews claimed the city belonged to them, saying that its founder had been a Jew, this was King Herod, while the others, admitting the founder was a Jew, maintained that the city itself belonged to the Greeks, since Herod would never have set up statues and temples in it had he intended it for Jews. Over this, the two sides disputed, and their rivalry advanced to weapons, with the bolder men on both sides rushing out to fight each day. For the Jewish elders were unable to restrain their own agitators, and the Greeks thought it a disgrace to be bested by Jews. The Jews had the advantage in wealth and bodily strength, the Greek population in the support of the soldiers, since the greater part of the Roman force stationed there had been levied from Syria, and being kinsmen of the Syrians were ready to assist them. The governors, for their part, were concerned to suppress the disturbance, and constantly arrested the more violent troublemakers and punished them with whips and chains. Yet the sufferings of those arrested caused no restraint or fear among those left behind. Rather, they were provoked all the more toward the strife. Once, when the Jews were winning, Felix came forward into the marketplace and with threats ordered them to withdraw. When they did not obey, he sent the soldiers against them and killed a great many, whose property was in the process plundered. As the strife continued, he selected notable men from each side and sent them as envoys to Nero to plead their rights. Festus, succeeding Felix in the procuratorship, went after what was most damaging the country. He captured a great many of the bandits and destroyed not a few. But Albinus, who came after Festus, did not conduct affairs in the same way. There was no form of wrongdoing he left untried. Not only did he steal from and plunder private estates in matters of public business, and not only did he burden the whole nation with taxes, but he also ransomed back to their relatives, for a price, those imprisoned for banditry by local councils or by earlier procurators, and only the man who paid nothing to the prisons was left behind as a criminal. At that time, the boldness of those in Jerusalem who wished for revolution grew reckless. The powerful men among them won Albinus over with money, so that he would allow them freedom to foment strife, while the common people, who found no joy in quiet, inclined toward Albinus's associates. Each of these ruffians, girded about with his own band, stood out from the pack like a bandit chief or a tyrant, and used his bodyguard to plunder the more moderate citizens. The result was that those who had been robbed had to keep silent about what should have provoked their outrage, while those still untouched, out of fear of suffering the same fate, flattered a man who deserved punishment. In short, free speech everywhere was cut off, and tyranny prevailed on many fronts, and it was from this time that the seeds of the coming destruction were sown in the city. Such was Albinus, yet Gessius Florus, who came after him, made him appear excellent by comparison. Albinus did most of his wrongdoing furtively and with some concealment, but Gessius paraded his crimes against the nation openly, and, as though sent as an executioner to punish condemned men, left out no form of plunder or outrage. In pitiable cases, he was most savage, in shameful ones most shameless. No one ever poured greater contempt on the truth, and no one devised more cunning paths of villainy. To him, gain taken man by man seemed a small thing. He stripped whole cities bare and ruined entire populations, and all but proclaimed throughout the country that everyone was free to plunder, provided he himself received a share of the spoils. Because of his greed, it came about that all the cities were left desolate, and many people abandoned their ancestral ways and fled into foreign provinces. As long as Cestius Gallus governed the province of Syria, no one dared send an embassy to him against Florus. But when he came to Jerusalem while the festival of unleavened bread was underway, the people, no fewer than 3 million, crowded around him begging him to have pity on the nation's sufferings and cried out against Florus as the scourge of the country. Florus, who was present and standing beside Cestius, mocked their cries. Cestius, however, having quieted the crowd's impulse and given them reason to hope that he would make Florus more moderate toward them in the future, returned to Antioch. Florus escorted him as far as Caesarea, all the while deceiving him, and already contemplating war against the nation as the only means by which he supposed he could conceal his own crimes, for he expected that in time of peace the Jews would bring accusers before Caesar, whereas by engineering their revolt, he would use the greater disaster to divert scrutiny away from the milder charges. So, to make sure the nation would be driven to break away, he increased their sufferings day by day. Meanwhile, the Greeks of Caesarea, having won from Nero the right to govern the city, brought back the documents recording the verdict, and the war took its beginning in the 12th year of Nero's reign, the 17th of Agrippa's kingship, in the month Artemisios. The pretext for it was not proportionate to the scale of the disasters that followed from it. The Jews of Caesarea had a synagogue next to a plot of ground whose owner was a Greek of Caesarea. They had often tried to buy the place, offering a price many times its value. But when he scorned their pleas and, to spite them further, built over the plot, putting up workshops and leaving them only a narrow and thoroughly cramped passage, the hotter-headed of the young men at first rushed forward and tried to stop the building. When Florus checked them from using force, the leading men among the Jews, John the tax collector among them, in their helplessness persuaded Florus for 8 talents of silver to stop the work. He, intent only on getting the money, promised to do everything asked of him, but once he had taken it, he left Caesarea for Sebaste and abandoned the dispute to run its own course, as if he had sold the Jews a license to fight. The next day, a Sabbath, when the Jews had gathered at the synagogue, a certain rabble-rouser of Caesarea overturned a pot at their entrance and set it up to sacrifice birds on it. This drove the Jews to an incurable fury, feeling both that their laws had been outraged and that the place had been defiled. The steady and moderate among them thought they ought to take refuge with the authorities, but the seditious element, inflamed by youth, blazed up for a fight. The rioters of Caesarea stood ready, having sent the sacrificer ahead by prior arrangement, and a clash quickly broke out. Jucundus, the cavalry commander assigned to prevent it, came forward, removed the pot, and tried to put an end to the disturbance, but overpowered by the violence of the Caesareans, the Jews snatched up their scrolls of the law and withdrew to Narbata, a district of theirs 60 stadia from Caesarea. Meanwhile, the 12 leading men around John went to Florus at Sebaste, lamented what had happened, and begged for help, delicately reminding him of the 8 talents. He had the men arrested and put in chains, charging them with carrying the law out of Caesarea. At this, there was outrage in Jerusalem, but the people still held their tempers in check. Florus, however, as if he had contracted to fan the war into flame, sent to the sacred treasury and removed 17 talents, pretending it was for Caesar's needs. At once confusion seized the people. They ran together to the temple, calling on Caesar's name with piercing cries and begging to be freed from Florus's tyranny. Some of the rioters shouted the foulest abuse at Florus and, carrying a basket around, demanded coins for him, as if he were a pauper in need. This did nothing to check his greed for money. It only provoked him to extort still more. So instead of going to Caesarea, as he should have, to put out the fire of war that had begun there and remove the causes of the unrest, which was, after all, what he was paid to do, he marched on Jerusalem with a force of cavalry and infantry, so that by Roman arms, by fear, and by threats he might strip the city bare. The people, wanting to disarm his fury in advance, went out to meet the soldiers with acclamations, and made ready to receive Florus with every courtesy. But he sent ahead the centurion Capito with 50 horsemen and ordered them to withdraw, telling them not to mock him now with these professions of friendliness after abusing him so shamefully. For if they were truly noble and outspoken, they should mock him to his face, and prove themselves lovers of liberty not only in words, but in arms as well. Terrified by this, and further scattered as Capito's horsemen bore down into their midst, the crowd dispersed before they could greet Florus or show the soldiers their obedience. They withdrew to their houses and passed the night in fear and humiliation. Florus spent that night quartered in the palace. The next day he had a tribunal set up before it and took his seat, and the chief priests, the leading men, and the most notable citizens of the city came forward and presented themselves before the tribunal. Florus ordered them to hand over the men who had abused him, telling them they would feel his vengeance unless they produced the guilty parties. They replied that the people were peaceably disposed and asked pardon for those who had spoken out of turn. For in so great a crowd it was no wonder that some were more reckless and, because of their youth, thoughtless, and it was impossible to pick out the guilty one by one, since every offender, once he repented, denied what he had done. If they said, he truly cared for peace in the nation and wished to preserve the city for Rome, he ought, for the sake of the many who were blameless, to forgive the few who had offended, rather than throw so good a people into turmoil for the sake of a few troublemakers. This only provoked Florus further. He shouted an order to his soldiers to plunder the so-called upper market and kill whomever they met. Greedy for gain, and taking their commander's order as encouragement, they not only plundered the district to which they had been sent, but rushed into every house and slaughtered the occupants. There was flight through the alleys and slaughter of all who were caught. No form of plunder was left untried, and many respectable citizens were seized and brought before Florus, who first had them scourged and then crucified. The total number of those who perished that day, counting women and children, for not even infants were spared, came to about 630. What made the calamity still more grievous was the novelty of this Roman cruelty, what no one had ever dared before, Florus now did scourging men of equestrian rank before the tribunal and nailing them to the cross, men who, whatever their birth as Jews, held Roman rank. At this time, King Agrippa happened to be away in Alexandria, congratulating Alexander, whom Nero had entrusted with the governance of Egypt. His sister Berenice, however, was present in Jerusalem, and as she watched the soldiers' lawless violence, a terrible anguish came over her. Again and again, she sent her cavalry commanders and bodyguards to Florus, begging him to stop the killing. But he, looking neither to the number of the slain nor to the rank of the woman pleading with him, but only to the profit to be made from the plunder, paid no heed. The soldiers' fury even turned against the queen herself. Not only did they torture and kill their victims before her very eyes, but they would have killed her too, had she not fled in time to the royal palace, where she spent the night under guard, dreading the soldiers' assault. She was staying in Jerusalem at the time to fulfill a vow to God, for it is the custom for those afflicted by illness or by other troubles to vow, 30 days before the sacrifice they intend to offer, to abstain from wine and to shave their heads. It was in the midst of performing this very rite that Berenice, barefoot, stood before the tribunal pleading with Florus, and far from meeting with any respect, she found herself in danger of her life. These events took place on the 16th of the month Artemisios. The next day, the grief-stricken populace streamed into the upper market and raised loud cries of lamentation over the dead. Most of the shouting, though, was hatred directed at Florus. At this, the leading men, together with the chief priests, grew afraid. They tore their garments and, falling before each person in turn, begged them to stop and not provoke Florus into some irreparable act on top of what they had already suffered. The people were quickly persuaded, out of respect for those who appealed to them and in the hope that Florus would commit no further outrage against them. But once the disturbance had died down, Florus was displeased and set about rekindling it. He summoned the chief priests and the notable men and told them the only proof that the people intended no further revolt would be if they went out to meet the soldiers coming up from Caesarea. Two cohorts were on their way. While the chief priests were still convening the crowd, he sent word ahead instructing the centurions of the cohorts to tell their men neither to return the Jews' greeting, and, if the Jews said anything against him, to use their weapons. The chief priests gathered the people into the temple and urged them to go out and meet the Romans, and to greet the cohorts before some irreparable disaster occurred. But the seditious element would not obey, and because of those who had died, the people leaned toward the more reckless. At this, every priest and every minister of God brought out the sacred vessels and the vestments in which it was their custom to perform their service, and the harpists and hymn singers, together with their instruments, threw themselves down and implored the people to preserve these sacred ornaments for them and not provoke the Romans into plundering the divine treasures. The chief priests themselves could be seen with their heads smeared with dust, their chests bare where they had torn their garments. They called each notable man by name, and the people as a whole, begging them not to betray their homeland, for the sake of the smallest offense, to those eager to destroy it. For what benefit, they asked, would it bring the soldiers if the Jews greeted them, or what remedy would it bring for what had already happened if they failed to go out now? But if they welcomed those approaching, as was customary, Florus would be deprived of any pretext for war, and they themselves would keep their homeland and suffer nothing further. Besides, to obey a handful of rioters when they themselves, being so great a people, ought instead to compel even those men to see reason was sheer folly. Softened by these words, the people, together with the leading citizens, restrained the rioters, some by threats and some by appeals to shame. Then, leading the way in quiet and orderly fashion, they went out to meet the soldiers and greeted them as they drew near. But when the soldiers made no reply, the rioters began shouting against Florus. This was the prearranged signal against them. At once the soldiers surrounded them and struck them with clubs, and the cavalry, pursuing those who fled, trampled them underfoot. Many fell, beaten down by the Romans, but more were crushed by one another in the press. There was a terrible crush at the gates, and as each man rushed to get through ahead of the rest, the flight became slower for everyone, and the destruction of those who stumbled was dreadful. For they were suffocated and crushed by the weight of the crowd pressing in on them, and vanished without trace, so that not even a relative was left behind to recognize them for burial. Soldiers too fell upon them, striking down without discrimination those they overtook, and drove the crowd by force through the place called Bethesda, struggling to get past and to seize control of the temple and the Antonia fortress. Florus, aiming at the same objective, led out from the royal palace the men who were with him and strove to reach the fortress. But he failed in his design, for the people turned to face him directly and blocked his advance, and, spreading out over the rooftops, pelted the Romans with missiles. Worn down by the shots raining down from above, and too weak to cut through the crowd choking the alleys, they withdrew to the camp beside the palace. The rioters, fearing that Florus might attack again and seize the temple by way of the Antonia, at once went up and cut through the colonnades connecting the temple to the Antonia. This cooled Florus's greed, for he had been eager to get at God's treasures, and it was for that reason he wished to gain access to the Antonia, but once the colonnades were broken off, his ambition was checked. He summoned the chief priests and the council and told them he himself intended to leave the city, but would leave behind whatever garrison they thought fit. When they promised full responsibility for security and for keeping the peace, provided he left them one cohort, though not the one that had fought, since the people bore that cohort particular ill will for what they had suffered, he exchanged the cohort as they asked and withdrew to Caesarea with the rest of his force. Seeking another pretext to further the war, he wrote to Cestius, falsely charging the Jews with revolt, laying the blame for the start of the fighting on them, and claiming that they had done what in fact they themselves had suffered. Nor did the magistrates of Jerusalem stay silent. They and Berenice wrote to Cestius as well about Florus's lawless conduct in the city. Cestius, having read both accounts, took counsel with his officers. Some advised him to march up with an army, either to punish the revolt, if it had really occurred, or to secure the Jews more firmly in their loyalty. Others advised him to send ahead one of his staff officers to investigate the situation and report faithfully on the Jews' state of mind. He sent one of his tribunes, Neoplatonus, who, on the road, encountered King Agrippa returning from Alexandria near Jamnia and informed him who had sent him and why. There too the chief priests, together with the leading men and the council, came to greet the king. After paying him their respects, they poured out their own sufferings and recounted Florus's cruelty. Agrippa was indignant at this, but with a statesman's tact, he turned his anger toward the very Jews he pitied, wishing to humble their spirit, and by making it seem they had not suffered unjustly, to turn them away from thoughts of retaliation. The leading men, being men of standing and, because of their own property, eager for peace, understood the king's rebuke as well meant. But the common people went out 60 stadia from Jerusalem to greet Agrippa and Neoplatonus. The wives of the murdered men ran ahead wailing, and at their cries of grief, the people broke into lamentation and begged Agrippa to help them. They cried out to Neoplatonus over all they had suffered at Florus's hands, and when they entered the city, they showed him the deserted marketplace and the plundered houses. Then, through Agrippa, they persuaded Neoplatonus to walk through the city as far as Siloam with a single attendant, so that he might see for himself that the Jews submitted to all other Romans and hated only Florus, because of the excess of his cruelty toward them. When he had gone through the city and gained sufficient proof of their peaceable temper, he went up to the temple. There he called the people together, and after praising them at length for their loyalty to Rome and urging them much, Agrippa urged them to keep the peace, and then, having worshipped God from the place where the sanctuary could be seen, went back to Cestius. But the crowd of the Jews turned to the king and the chief priests and pressed them to send envoys to Nero against Florus, and not, by staying silent over so much bloodshed, leave themselves open to the suspicion of revolt. For they would appear to have begun the fighting themselves if they did not act first to point out who had actually begun it. It was plain that they would not calm down if anyone tried to stop the embassy. To Agrippa, appointing men to bring charges against Florus seemed likely to provoke resentment, but standing by, while the Jews were fanned into war, did not seem to serve his own interests either. So he summoned the crowd to the Xystus, stationed his sister Berenice where all could see her at the house of the Hasmoneans, which stood above the Xystus, facing the upper city, with a bridge joining the Xystus to the temple, and Agrippa spoke as follows. If I saw all of you determined to make war on the Romans, and not the purest and most sincere part of the people preferring to keep the peace, I would never have come before you, nor ventured to offer advice. For any speech urging what ought to be done is wasted once an entire audience has agreed on the worst course. But since some of you, through youth, have no experience of the horrors of war, some are swayed by a reckless hope of freedom, and others are goaded by simple greed and by the profit to be made from the weak, once matters are thrown into confusion, so that these people, brought back to their senses, might change their minds, and the innocent not suffer for the bad judgment of a few. I thought it right to gather you all in one place and tell you what I believe serves your interest. Let no one raise an uproar against me if he does not like what he hears, for those set irrevocably on revolt can go on thinking as they do even after I have spoken. But for me, the speech is wasted even on those willing to listen, unless everyone keeps silent. I know that many turn the outrages of the procurators and the praises of freedom into high drama. But before I examine who you are and whom you propose to fight, let me first untangle the knot of pretexts you offer. If you are defending yourselves against wrongdoers, why make so much of freedom? If you think slavery itself unbearable, then your complaint against your governors is beside the point, for slavery is equally shameful even under governors who behave with restraint. Consider each of these grievances in turn and see how slight a foundation they give for war. Take first the charges against the procurators. Those in power need to be placated, not provoked. When you turn small faults into great denunciations, you only convict yourselves in the process, and you drive men who might have wronged you secretly, out of some shame, into wronging you openly instead. Nothing checks blows so well as bearing them, and the patient endurance of the wronged is itself a rebuke that unsettles the wrongdoer. But grant that the Roman officials are incorrigibly harsh. It is not yet true that all Romans wrong you, still less Caesar, against whom you are actually choosing to make war. No villain comes from them by his order, nor can those in the West easily even hear, let alone act on, what happens under the eastern sky so quickly. It is absurd to make war on so many because of one man, and for petty causes against people so great, people who do not even know what we accuse them of. Our own grievances could be put right quickly enough, since no procurator stays forever, and his successors are likely to prove more moderate. But a war, once set in motion, cannot easily be laid down again without disaster, nor easily carried through either. As for wanting freedom now, the moment for that has passed, you should have fought to keep from ever losing it in the first place. The experience of slavery is bitter, and the struggle to avoid ever entering it is a just one. But the man who has once been mastered and only then revolts is a stubborn slave, not a lover of liberty. That was the time to do everything possible to keep the Romans out, when Pompey first set foot in this land. But our ancestors and their kings, though far superior to you in wealth, in strength, and in spirit, could not hold out against even a small fraction of Roman power. And you, who have inherited mere submission by succession, so much weaker in resources than those who first submitted, mean to stand against the whole dominion of Rome. Even the Athenians, who once gave up their own city to the flames for the freedom of the Greeks, who chased the arrogant Xerxes, the man who marched over land and sailed over sea, whom the seas could not contain though he led an army wider than Europe, like a runaway on a single ship, and who broke the might of all Asia around little Salamis, now serve the Romans, and the city that once led Greece takes its orders from Italy. The Spartans, after Thermopylae and Plataea and their Agesilaus who ransacked Asia, are content with the same masters, and the Macedonians, who still dream of Philip and of the world dominion that spread out before them under Alexander, bear this same great reversal and bow before the ones to whom fortune has now turned. Countless other nations, with far stronger grounds for asserting their freedom, submit. You alone think it disgraceful to serve those to whom everything else is subject. With what army, trusting in what weapons, do you mean to fight? Where is the fleet that will dispute the Roman seas for you? Where are the treasuries to fund your ambitions? Do you imagine you are going to war against Egyptians and Arabs? Will you not take the measure of Roman power? Will you not weigh your own weakness? Our forces and those of our neighbors have been defeated again and again, while Roman strength stands unconquered across the world, and even that has not satisfied them. The whole Euphrates in the east was not enough for them, nor the Danube in the north, Nor Libya searched to its uninhabited southern edge, nor Gads in the west. They sought out another world beyond the ocean and carried their arms as far as the Britons, unknown to history before them. What then? Are you richer than the Gauls, stronger than the Germans, more clever than the Greeks, more numerous than every people on earth? What gives you the confidence to rise against Rome? Slavery is harsh, someone will say. How much more so for the Greeks, who surpass every people under the sun in nobility of birth and hold so vast a territory, yet bow before six Roman rods, as do the Macedonians, who have a far better claim than you to fight for their freedom. And the 500 cities of Asia, do they not, without even a garrison, bow before a single governor and his consular rods? Need I mention the Heniaci, the Colchians, the tribe of the Tauri, the people of the Bosporus, and the nations around the Pontus and Lake Meotes? Among them, formerly, not even a ruler of their own kind was recognized. Now 3,000 hoplites hold them in check, and 40 warships have brought peace to a sea once unnavigable and wild. Bithynia, Cappadocia, the Pamphylian people, the Lycians, the Cilicians, for all they might say about freedom, do they not pay tribute without needing a single soldier to enforce it? And the Thracians, who occupy a land 5 days wide and seven long, rougher and far better defended than yours, whose bitter cold turns back any invader, do they not obey 2,000 Roman guards? The Illyrians beyond them, who inhabit the territory cut off toward Dalmatia by the Danube, submit to no more than 2 legions, with whose help they themselves hold back the raids of the Dacians. And the Dalmatians, who rose up for freedom so many times, and who, no sooner subdued than they gathered their strength to revolt again, now keep still under a single Roman legion. If any people had grounds great enough to justify revolt, it should have been the Gauls, walled in by nature itself. The Alps to the east, the river Rhine to the north, the Pyrenees to the south, the ocean to the west. Yet surrounded by such barriers, numbering 305 nations, holding what one might call the very springs of prosperity and flooding nearly the whole world with their goods, they endure being a source of Roman revenue, their own prosperity managed for them by others. And they endure this not from any weakness of spirit or lack of manly courage. They fought for 80 years for their freedom. But because, along with Roman power, they were overawed by the fortune that serves Rome even better than her arms do. And so they serve under 1,200 soldiers, though they have almost more cities than that. Not even the gold mined by the Iberians was enough to sustain their war for freedom, nor the great distance separating them from Rome by land and sea, nor the fierce tribes of the Lusitanians and Cantabrians, nor the neighboring ocean with its tides, fearsome even to the natives themselves. The Romans stretched their arms beyond the pillars of Heracles, marched through the clouds over the Pyrenees, and enslaved these peoples too. A single garrison sufficed for men so hard to fight and so far removed. Who among you has not heard of the vast numbers of the Germans? You have surely seen for yourselves, often enough, their strength and the size of their bodies, since Romans everywhere keep captives taken from them. Yet these people, who range over boundless land, whose spirit is greater even than their bodies, whose souls despise death and whose tempers outdo the fiercest of wild beasts, are held to the Rhine as the limit of their advance, and tamed by 8 Roman legions. Those taken captive serve as slaves, while the rest of their nation survives only by flight. Consider, too, the wall of the Britons, you who put your trust in the walls of Jerusalem. Though ringed by the ocean and inhabiting an island no smaller than our own known world, the Romans sailed there and enslaved them too, and 4 legions now guard so great an island. And what need is there to say more, when even the Parthians, the most warlike of races, ruling so many nations and possessing such power, send hostages to Rome, and one can see in Italy, under the pretense of peace, the nobility of the East living in servitude. When nearly every people under the sun bows before Roman arms, will you alone go to war, without even considering the fate of the Carthaginians, who, for all their pride in the great Hannibal and their Phoenician nobility, fell before the hand of Scipio? Neither the Cyrenians of Spartan stock, nor the Marmoridae, the tribe that stretches to the parched desert, nor the Seats, dreaded even by those who only hear of them, nor the Nasamons, the Moors, and the countless multitude of the Numidians checked the might of Rome. And the third part of the inhabited world, whose peoples are not even easy to count, bounded by the Atlantic Sea and the Pillars of Heracles and reaching to the Red Sea, home to the boundless Ethiopian peoples. All of it they have subdued, and beyond the yearly crops that feed the population of Rome for 8 months, its peoples are taxed in every other way as well, and readily supply what the empire needs, counting none of these demands an outrage, as you do. Even though only a single legion remains stationed among them. And what need is there to point you to Rome's power from far away, when Egypt lies close at hand, stretching to the Ethiopians and Arabia, Felix, serving as the harbor of India, holding 7.5 million people apart from the residents of Alexandria, as one can reckon from the poll tax, and yet does not think Roman rule beneath it, even though it has in Alexandria such a spark for revolt, given the sheer number of its men, its wealth, and besides that its size. Alexandria's length alone is 30 stads, its width no less than 10, and in a single month it delivers more to Rome than your whole year's tribute, and beyond money, grain enough to feed Rome for 4 months. And it is walled on every side by impassable deserts, harborless seas, rivers, or marshes. Yet none of this was found stronger than Rome's fortune, and two legions stationed in the city hold deep Egypt in check, along with the Macedonian nobility there. What allies, then, will you find for this war, out of an uninhabited world? Everyone within the inhabited world is Roman, unless someone stretches his hopes beyond the Euphrates and Imagines, the kinsmen of Adiabene will come to his aid. But they will not entangle themselves in so great a war without good reason, nor will the Parthian king allow it even if they should decide badly. For he is careful to preserve his truce with Rome, and will regard it as breaking the treaty if any of his subjects marches against the Romans. It remains, then, to take refuge in the help of God. But even this stands arrayed on the side of Rome, for without God it would be impossible for so vast an empire to have been established. Consider, too, how the strictness of your own religion, even if you were fighting an easily beaten enemy, would make war hard to manage, and how the very observances by which you hope to keep God as your ally, you will be forced to break, and so turn him away instead. Keep the customs of the Sabbath, refuse to act on any matter on that day, and you will easily be taken, just as your ancestors were by Pompey, who made those very days the busiest time of his siege, since the besieged themselves stayed idle on them. But break your ancestral law in the course of the war, and I do not know what you will still be fighting for, since your one concern is to preserve your ancestral customs intact. How will you call on the divine for help, once you yourselves have willingly broken the service you owe it? All who go to war rely on either divine or human help. But when both are cut off as likely sources of aid, those who still fight are choosing plain destruction for themselves. What is there to stop you from killing your own children and wives with your own hands and burning this most beautiful of homelands? Madness of that kind would at least spare you the reproach of defeat. It is good, friends, it is good, while the ship is still in harbor, to look ahead to the coming storm, rather than be swept into the middle of the gales and perish there. Those who fall into disasters they could not foresee at least keep the world's pity, but a man who rushes toward plain destruction earns reproach as well. Unless, that is, someone imagines he will fight on agreed terms, and that the Romans, once victorious, will show you moderation, rather than to make an example for the other nations, burn the sacred city and destroy your whole race. For even if you survive, you will find no place to flee, since every people either already has the Romans as masters or fears having them. And the danger is not only for those here, but also for those living in other cities. There is no nation on the inhabited earth that does not contain some portion of our people, and if you go to war, your enemies will slaughter all of them, and because of a few men's bad judgment, every city will be filled with the blood of Jews. Those who did it would find some excuse, but if it does not happen, consider how impious it is to raise arms against a people so humane. Let pity move you, if not for your children and wives, then at least for this mother city and its sacred precincts. Spare the temple and keep the sanctuary with its holy things for yourselves, for the Romans will no longer spare what they have taken, once they have gotten no thanks for sparing it before. I call to witness your holy things, God's sacred angels, and our common homeland, that I have held back nothing that might save you. If you decide on what is necessary, you will have peace together with me, but if you are carried away by passion, you will face the danger without me." Having said this, he broke into tears together with his sister, and by his weeping checked much of the crowd's impulse. Yet they cried out that it was not against Rome but against Florus, for what they had suffered, that they meant to fight. To this King Agrippa replied, "But your actions are already those of men at war with Rome. You have not paid Caesar his tribute, and you have torn down the porticos joining the Antonia. You could remove the grounds for the charge of revolt if you rebuild these and pay the tax, for the fortress does not belong to Florus, nor would you be giving the money to Florus." The people were persuaded by this, and going up to the temple together with the king and Berenice, they began rebuilding the porticos, while the magistrates and counselors dispersed through the villages to collect the taxes. The 40 talents still owing were quickly gathered. In this way, Agrippa held off the threat of war for the time. But when he next tried to persuade the people to obey Florus until Caesar sent a successor in his place, they were provoked, cursed the king, and proclaimed him banished from the city. Some of the rebels even dared to throw stones at him. Seeing that the impulse of the revolutionaries was now beyond restraint, and angered at the insult done to him, the king sent their leaders, along with the men of standing, to Florus at Caesarea, so that Florus might appoint from among them men to collect the region's taxes, while he himself withdrew to his own kingdom. Meanwhile, some of those most eager to stir up war banded together and rushed against a fortress called Masada. Seizing it by stealth, they killed the Roman garrison and installed men of their own in its place. At the same time, in the temple, Eleazar, son of the high priest Ananias, a most audacious young man then serving as captain, persuaded those who officiated in the sacred rites to accept no gift or sacrifice from any foreigner. This was the true foundation of the war against Rome, for by it they rejected the sacrifice offered on Caesar's behalf. Although the chief priests and the notables urged them at length not to abandon the custom of sacrificing for their rulers, they would not yield, relying heavily on their own numbers. For the most vigorous of the revolutionaries supported them, and looking above all to Eleazar, who held command. So the men of standing came together with the chief priests and the notable Pharisees, and, as though the situation were already beyond remedy, they took counsel about the whole matter. Having decided to try persuading the rebels by argument, they gathered the people before the bronze gate, which faced east on the inner side of the temple. First, they reproached them at length for the audacity of their revolt and for threatening their homeland with so great a war. Then they exposed the unreasonableness of their pretext, pointing out that their ancestors had adorned the temple mostly with gifts from foreigners, had always accepted the offerings of outside nations, and had never once forbidden anyone sacrifice, for that would be most impious, but had even set up around the temple the votive offerings still visible after so long a time. These men, by contrast, were now provoking the arms of Rome and courting war from that quarter, introducing a strange innovation in worship, and, along with the danger, condemning the city to impiety, if among the Jews alone no foreigner might sacrifice or worship. If such a rule were imposed on even a single private citizen, they said, people would be indignant at so inhuman a restriction. Yet they overlooked it when Rome and Caesar were being excluded from the covenant. They said they feared that, having cast aside the sacrifices offered on Rome's behalf, the Jews might themselves be forbidden to offer sacrifices for their own sake, and that the city might be cut off from the empire's protection, unless they quickly came to their senses, restored the sacrifices, and corrected the wrong before word of the outrage reached those they had insulted. While saying this, they brought forward priests learned in the ancestral traditions, who testified that all their forebears had accepted sacrifices from foreigners. But none of the revolutionaries paid any attention, nor would the men bent on brigandage, busy laying the foundations of war, come near them. Seeing then that the rebellion was already hard to put down by their own efforts, and that the danger from Rome would fall upon them first, the men of standing tried to clear themselves of blame. They sent envoys to Florus, led by Simon son of Ananias, and others to Agrippa, among them the notables Saul, Antipas, and Costobar, kinsmen of the king. They asked both to come up to the city with a force, and before the revolt became unmanageable, to crush it. For Florus, this was welcome news of a grim kind, and since he had already resolved to kindle the war, he gave the envoys no answer. Agrippa, however, caring equally for those in revolt and for those against whom the war was being raised, and wishing the Jews to be preserved for Rome and the temple and mother city to be preserved for the Jews, knowing besides that the disturbance would bring him no advantage, sent 2,000 cavalry to help the people, Oronites, Batanians, and Trachonites, under the cavalry commander Darius, with Philip's son of Jasimus as general. Emboldened by these forces, the men of standing, together with the chief priests and all of the populace that loved peace, seized the upper city, while the rebels held the lower city and the temple. Both sides used slingstones and long-range weapons without pause, and there was a constant exchange of missiles from either quarter. At times, companies sallied out and fought hand to hand, the rebels excelling in daring, the king's men in experience. For the king's men, the chief aim of the struggle was to gain control of the temple and drive out those defiling it, while the rebels under Eleazar sought, in addition to what they already held, to seize the upper city as well. For 7 days there was heavy slaughter on both sides, and neither yielded the ground it held. On the following day, the feast of wood carrying took place, at which it was everyone's custom to bring wood for the altar, so that fuel for the fire would never fail, since it burns unquenched forever. On this day the rebels shut out those who differed with them in religion, but let in, mixed among the weak crowd of ordinary worshippers, many of the Sicarii, for so they called the brigands who carried daggers hidden under their cloaks, and having gained these recruits, they attacked their task more boldly. The king's men were overcome by numbers and daring, and yielded the upper city to their assault. The rebels then set fire to the house of the high priest Ananias and to the palaces of Agrippa and Berenice. After that, they carried fire to the public archives, eager to destroy the bonds of moneylenders and cut off the collection of debts, so as to win over a great number of those who had benefited and, with impunity, incite the poor to rise against the rich. When those in charge of the record office fled, they set it ablaze. When they had thus burned out the sinews of the city, they moved against their enemies. At this point, some of the men of standing and the chief priests slipped away into hiding in underground channels, while others, together with the king's men, fled into the upper palace and quickly shut its gates. Among them were the high priest Ananias, his brother Ezekias, and those who had gone as envoys to Agrippa. For that day, satisfied with their victory and with what they had burned, they rested. The next day, the 15th of the month Lous, they attacked the Antonia, and after besieging its garrison for 2 days, they captured them, cut them down, and burned the fortress. Then they moved on to the palace into which the king's men had fled, and dividing themselves into 4 divisions, made trial of the walls. None of those inside dared to sally out, given the numbers massed against them, but spreading along the parapets and towers they shot at those who approached, and many of the brigands fell beneath the walls. The fighting went on without pause, day and night, the rebels expecting that those inside would give out from lack of food, and those inside expecting that the besiegers would tire. Meanwhile, a certain Menahem, son of Judas called the Galilean, a most formidable teacher who once, in the time of Quirinius, had rebuked the Jews for submitting to Rome after already submitting to God, took his followers and withdrew to Masada. There he broke open King Herod's armory, armed still more brigands besides the men of his own town, and using these as his bodyguard, returned to Jerusalem like a king. Becoming leader of the revolt, he took charge of directing the siege. They lacked siege engines and could not openly undermine the wall while missiles rained down from above. So from a distance they dug a tunnel to one of the towers, propped it up, then set fire to the supporting timber and withdrew. When the props had burned through, the tower suddenly collapsed, but another wall behind it came into view, already built up. For sensing the plot beforehand, perhaps also because the tower had shifted as it was being undermined, the defenders had built themselves this second rampart. At the sight of it, those who had not expected it, and who were already convinced they had won, were struck with dismay. Those inside sent word to Menahem and the leaders of the revolt, asking to withdraw under truce. And when this was granted only to the king's men and the local people, some went out. Despondency seized the Romans left behind alone, for they could neither overpower so great a multitude, nor would they stoop to ask for pledges of safety, thinking it a disgrace. And besides, they did not trust that such pledges, if given, would be honored. So, abandoning their camp as indefensible, they fled for refuge to the royal towers called Hippicus, Phasael, and Mariam. Menahem's men, bursting in where the soldiers had escaped from, killed as many as they caught who had not managed to flee in time, plundered the baggage, and burned the camp. This took place on the 6th of the month Gorpieus. On the following day, the high priest Ananias, who had been hiding near the drainage channel of the royal palace, was caught and killed by the brigands together with his brother Ezekias, and the rebels surrounded the towers and kept watch so that no soldier might escape. As for Menahem, the destruction of the fortified places and the death of the high priest Ananias swelled him with arrogance into cruelty. Believing he had no rival in the conduct of affairs, he became an insufferable tyrant. Eleazar's followers rose up against him, agreeing among themselves that, having revolted from Rome out of desire for freedom, they must not now surrender that freedom to a fellow citizen and endure him as a master. Even if he did nothing violent, he was, after all, of lower rank than themselves. And if anyone had to take overall command, it belonged to anyone rather than to him. Having agreed on this, they made their attempt against him at the temple, for he had gone up arrogantly to worship, adorned in royal robes and trailing armed zealots behind him. When Eleazar's men rushed at him, the rest of the people too, roused to anger, snatched up stones and pelted the teacher, believing that if he were destroyed, the whole revolt would be turned aside. Menahem's men held out for a little while, but when they saw the whole crowd rushing upon them, they fled each as best he could. Those who were caught were killed, and a search was made for those in hiding. Only a few escaped safely, slipping off in secret to Masada, among them Eleazar son of Jairus, a kinsman of Menahem, who later became tyrant of Masada. As for Menahem himself, he fled to a place called Ophlas and was hiding there in disgrace. They took him alive, dragged him out into the open, tortured him with many torments, and killed him, and likewise his subordinate commanders, including Absalom, the most conspicuous agent of his tyranny. The people, as I have said, had joined in this action hoping for some correction of the whole revolt. But those who killed Menahem had done so not to end the war, but so as to wage it more freely, now that they had nothing to fear from him. In fact, though the people repeatedly urged the soldiers to relax the siege, the rebels pressed on more fiercely, until at last Metilius and his men, Metilius was the Roman prefect, no longer able to hold out, sent word to Eleazar asking for their lives alone under truce, saying they would hand over their weapons and all their other property. Eleazar's men eagerly seized on this plea and sent back to them Gorion son of Nicomedes, Ananias son of Sadduc, and Judas son of Jonathan, to give pledges and oaths. When this had been done, Metilius led his soldiers down. As long as they remained under arms, none of the rebels attacked them or showed any sign of treachery. But once, in accordance with the agreement, all of them had laid down their shields and swords and, no longer suspecting anything, were withdrawing, Eleazar's men rushed upon them, surrounded them, and cut them down as they neither defended themselves nor begged for mercy, but only cried out the terms of the treaty and the oaths sworn. All of them were thus savagely slaughtered, except Metilius, for he alone was spared, because he begged for his life and promised to become a Jew, even to the point of circumcision. To the Romans, the loss was slight, since only a few had perished out of their vast forces, but to the Jews it seemed the prelude to their own destruction. And when they saw that the causes of the war were now beyond remedy, and that the city was stained with so great a pollution, from which it was reasonable to expect some divine vengeance, even if not against the vengeance that would come from the Romans, the people mourned in public. The city was filled with dejection, and every moderate citizen was in turmoil, expecting that he himself would pay the penalty for the rebels' act. And indeed the killing had happened to fall on a Sabbath, the day on which, out of reverence, they abstain even from acts of piety. On that same day and hour, as though by some divine design, the people of Caesarea slaughtered the Jews living among them, so that within a single hour more than 20,000 were butchered, and the whole of Jewish Caesarea was emptied. For Florus seized those who escaped and led them off in chains to the dockyards. At the blow struck at Caesarea, the whole nation was driven wild, and splitting into bands, they ravaged the villages of the Syrians and the neighboring cities. Philadelphia, Heshbon's territory, Gerasa, Pella, and Scythopolis. Then, falling on Gadara, Hippos, and the Golanitis, in some places they destroyed everything and in others set fires, and advanced on Cadassa belonging to Tyre, on Tolmais, on Gaba, and on Caesarea. Neither Sebast nor Ashkelon withstood their onslaught. After burning these, they razed Anthedon and Gaza to the ground. Many villages around each of these cities were plundered, and the killing of the men who were caught was beyond counting. Yet the Syrians killed no fewer Jews than they had lost. They too slaughtered those they seized in the cities, no longer only out of hatred, as before, but now also to forestall the danger they themselves faced. A terrible turmoil gripped the whole of Syria, and every city was split into two camps, since for each side safety lay in striking the other first. Days were spent in bloodshed, and nights, in fear, were harder still. For even when people thought they had cleared their towns of Jews, they still held those who merely lived like Jews under suspicion, and no one could bring himself to kill outright a person of mixed and doubtful loyalty, while they equally feared one who, though counted a foreigner among them, might in fact belong to the other side. Even men who had long seemed the gentlest were provoked to murder their rivals by greed, for they plundered without fear the property of the slain and carried off the spoils of the dead to their own houses as if from a battlefield. And the man who profited most was honored as though he had triumphed over the greatest number of enemies. One could see the cities full of unburied bodies, corpses of the old lying together with infants, and women stripped even of the covering owed to modesty. The whole province was filled with indescribable disasters, and the dread of what might yet be threatened was greater than the outrages already dared. Up to this point, the assaults of the Jews had been against foreign peoples. But when they overran Scythopolis, they found the Jews living there arrayed against them as enemies. For those Jews, siding with the people of Scythopolis and putting their own safety above their kinship, had ranged themselves alongside their fellow citizens against their own countrymen. Yet even their excessive zeal fell under suspicion. The Scythopolitans, fearing that these Jews might attack the city by night and at great cost to themselves, have to answer to their own people for having broken faith, ordered them, if they wished to confirm their loyalty and demonstrate their good faith toward the foreign population, to move with their families into the sacred grove. They did as they were commanded, without suspecting anything. For 2 days the Scythopolitans held still, luring them into false confidence, but on the third night, watching for the moment when some were off guard and others asleep, they slaughtered them all, more than 13,000 in number, and plundered the possessions of every one of them. It is worth relating also the fate of Simon, who was the son of a certain Saul, a man not without standing, and who, distinguished for strength of body and boldness, used both to the harm of his own people. Advancing day after day, he killed many of the Jews near Scythopolis, and often, single-handed, routing them all, he alone tipped the balance of the battle. A fitting penalty overtook him for the slaughter of his kinsmen. When the Scythopolitans surrounded the Jews and were shooting them down with javelins throughout the grove, he drew his sword but charged at none of the enemy, for he saw their numbers were beyond reckoning, and instead cried out in great anguish, "Scythopolitans, I suffer what I deserve for what I have done against you, we who by so much slaughter of our own kin proved our loyalty to you. So then, since it is with good reason that we are found untrustworthy as foreigners, and since our own people have been wronged to the utmost, let us die, guilty as we are, by our own hands, for it is not fitting that we die by the hands of enemies. This same act would also serve me as a fitting penalty for my crime and as praise for my courage, so that none of my enemies may boast of having killed me or gloat over my fall." Having said this, with eyes full of both pity and rage, he looked round upon his own family. He had a wife, children, and aged parents. First he seized his father by his white hair and ran him through with the sword. After him, his unresisting mother, and then his wife and children, each all but stepping forward to meet the blade, eager to forestall the enemy. Having gone through his whole family, and standing conspicuous over the bodies, he raised his right hand for all to see, and plunged the sword entirely into his own throat, a young man deserving of pity for the strength of his body and the steadfastness of his soul, though he suffered a fate to match his loyalty toward foreigners. After the disaster at Scythopolis, the rest of the cities rose up each against the Jews within them. The people of Ashkelon killed 2,500, the people of Tolmais killed 2,000, and imprisoned not a few. The people of Tyre put many to death, and kept most of the rest imprisoned. The people of Hippos and Gadara likewise disposed of the bolder ones, and kept the more dangerous under guard. While the rest of the cities of Syria acted each according to the measure of their hatred or fear of the Jewish people. Only the people of Antioch, Sidon, and Apamia spared those living among them and would not consent to kill or imprison any Jews, perhaps in part because their own numbers made them indifferent to any unrest among so few, but more, in my judgment, out of pity for a people they saw attempting nothing revolutionary. The people of Gerasa likewise did no wrong to those who stayed and escorted those who wished to leave as far as the borders. A plot against the Jews also arose in the kingdom of Agrippa. He himself had gone to Antioch to see Cestius Gallus, leaving one of his companions, named Noros, a kinsman of King Soemus, in charge of affairs. 70 men arrived from Batania, chosen among their fellow citizens for birth and judgment, asking for a garrison, so that if any disturbance should arise among them too, they would have an adequate force to prevent uprisings. Noros sent some of the royal soldiers out by night and had all of them killed, daring the deed against Agrippa's wishes and, driven by boundless greed, choosing to wrong his own countrymen and thereby ruining the kingdom's reputation. He continued to act lawlessly and cruelly against the nation until Agrippa, learning of it, was ashamed to have him killed for Soemus's sake, but removed him from his post. Meanwhile, the rebels, seizing a certain fortress called Cypros, which overlooks Jericho, slaughtered the garrison and razed the fortifications to the ground. In those same days, the mass of the Jews at Machaerus persuaded the Roman garrison to abandon the fortress and hand it over to them. Fearing to have it taken from them by force, the Romans agreed to withdraw under a truce, and having received pledges, they surrendered the fortress, which the men of Machaerus then took and held with a garrison of their own. In Alexandria, there had always been strife between the native population and the Jews. Ever since Alexander, finding the Jews most eager to help him against the Egyptians, granted them, as a reward for their alliance, the right to dwell in the city on equal footing with the Greeks. This honor was maintained for them also by his successors, who even set apart for them a district of their own, so that they might keep a purer way of life with less mixing with foreigners, and allowed them to be styled Macedonians. And when the Romans took possession of Egypt, neither the first Caesar nor any of his successors would consent to diminish the honors the Jews had received from Alexander. Yet there were constant clashes between them and the Greeks, and although the governors punished many on both sides every day, the strife was only further inflamed. But now, with disorder already stirred up everywhere else, matters among them blazed up all the more. When the Alexandrians held an assembly to decide on an embassy they intended to send to Nero, a great number of Jews streamed together with the Greeks into the amphitheater, and their opponents, catching sight of them, at once cried out that they were enemies and spies. Then, leaping up, they laid hands on them. The rest fled and scattered, but three men were seized and dragged off to be burned alive. At this, the whole Jewish population rose to their defense. At first, they hurled stones at the Greeks, then, snatching up torches, rushed toward the amphitheater, threatening to burn the whole populace alive within it. And they would have accomplished this had not Tiberius Alexander, the governor of the city, checked their fury. He did not, however, begin by turning to arms for the restoration of order, but sent the leading men among them privately to urge them to stop and not provoke the Roman army against themselves. But the rebellious element mocked his appeal and heaped abuse on Tiberius. When he saw that they would not desist short of some great disaster, he unleashed against them the two Roman legions stationed in the city, together with 2,000 soldiers who happened to be present, having arrived from Libya for the destruction of the Jews. He permitted them not only to kill, but also to plunder their property and burn their houses. The soldiers rushed into the quarter called Delta, where the Jewish population was concentrated, and carried out their orders, though not without bloodshed on their own side. For the Jews rallied together, put their best-armed men in front, and held out for a long while, but once they gave way, they were destroyed without mercy. Every kind of death befell them, some caught in the open, others crowded into their houses, which the Romans set on fire after first plundering what was inside, sparing neither infants out of pity nor old men out of respect, but cutting down every age, so that the whole district was flooded with blood and 50,000 corpses lay piled up. Even the remnant would not have survived had they not turned to supplication. Taking pity on them, Tiberius Alexander ordered the Romans to withdraw. The soldiers, accustomed to obey, ceased their killing at a single signal. But the Alexandrian populace, in the excess of their hatred, could barely be called off and were torn away from the bodies only with difficulty. Such was the disaster that befell Alexandria. Cestius, seeing that the Jews everywhere were now roused to war and that quiet could no longer be expected, took from Antioch the 12th legion at full strength, along with 2,000 picked men from each of the other legions, 6 cohorts of infantry, and 4 squadrons of cavalry, in addition to the allied contingents supplied by the kings. 2,000 cavalry and 3,000 archers, all infantry, from Antiochus. From Agrippa, an equal number of infantry and somewhat fewer than 2,000 cavalry, and Soemus followed with 4,000 men, a third of them cavalry and most of the rest archers. He advanced to Tolmais. A great many auxiliaries were also gathered from the cities, inferior to the regular soldiers in experience, but making up for their lack of skill with zeal and hatred of the Jews. Agrippa himself was present with Cestius, guiding him on the route and advising him on what would be useful. Taking part of his force, Cestius marched against a strong city of Galilee called Chabulon, which means of men, and which marks the boundary between the region and Tolmais. He found it empty of men, for the population had fled to the mountains, but full of goods of every kind. He allowed his soldiers to plunder what they found, and though he admired the beauty of the town, whose houses were built like those of Tyre, Sidon, and Berytus, he set it on fire. He then overran the countryside, plundering everything in his path and burning the surrounding villages before returning to Tolmais. While the Syrians, and especially the men of Berytus, were still occupied with the plunder, the Jews, taking heart and knowing that Cestius had withdrawn, fell unexpectedly upon those left behind and destroyed about 2,000 of them.